is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grahamian Bunker. Happy holidays, everybody. I am Micah Hanks, and it is almost Christmas here in the hollow earth. It is the Grahamian Report. Glad to have you with us, as always. Broadcasting worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. Tonight we're going to be looking at, well, a couple of big announcements in the world of radio broadcasting, as well as another possible big announcement. I know it's got the Flat Earth Society all worked up. Boy, they, I think, have gotten more press this year than not only should they have received, but probably more than they have ever received, due in part to this ridiculous controversy about the Flat Earth being reignited somehow. We covered that earlier in the year. We're not going to talk about it tonight, but I know that this story that we will be touching on has some Flat Earthers and conspiracy theorists all worked up. And then in hour two, there's going to be a rather unusual story that we're going to be covering. It's only about a year old. It remains unsolved, and it is certainly one for the books. A strange disappearance that has me baffled. And so we'll be digging into that just as well. Hope everybody's doing extremely well there in the chat room, of course, at KGRARadio.com. We simulcast, I guess that would be the proper terminology there. We simulcast that chat room at GrahamianReport.com, so you can actually access it at either our podcast page at GrahamianReport.com or there at KGRARadio.com. I guess I'm going to get right into the news tonight. No small talk, you know, no chatting around, because there's so much to cover. This is the big story. I went to Nashville over the weekend. I was sitting in on the 100th episode of the Conspiranormal podcast with Adam Sane and Luke and all the guys. Had a great time. Dr. Future, a.k.a. Dr. Mike Bennett, who, of course, we had on the program to talk about the Dark Skies Over Elberton documentary, which I think has really blown the lid off of the mystery of the Georgia Guidestones. He was there, and we got to catch up and spend a lot of time together. Mr. Nasty himself, Jeremy London, occasional co-host on this program, picked me up, and I was able to meet up with he and a longtime friend of mine, Justin Bilton, who has a lot of interest in the sort of archaeology, as well as some of the supernatural stuff that we talk about on this program. You may not know him by name, but Justin is the bassist for a group called Three Doors Down. They're based out of Nashville, and they'll be dropping their new album in January. Really excited about that. And, of course, they'll be heading off to Japan, I think, for a tour shortly thereafter. He's certainly doing well, but I told him, I said, you know, you and Jeremy and I, we've got to get together. He's got so many great stories about weird stuff. Not only just about when he's been on the road with the group, but other things, including his own personal experiences prior to that. And I said, you know, between you and Jeremy and I mean, really, we've got a whole series we should just do as podcasts. So I hope to launch that at some point. But the entire time I'm in Nashville over the weekend, catching up with my compatriots who follow this sort of stuff, everybody's asking me the same thing. What do you think about Art Bell? What do you think about Art Bell? I said, I love Art Bell. Why? What do you mean? No, apparently, there's been news. Art has hung up his microphone, and now they're saying for the last time. This was reported at artbell.com in a message that he posted to fans over the weekend, and it reads as follows. I'm sorry to have to announce this, but I will not be on tonight or any other night. Yes, I'm going to hang it up. Whoever this crazy person is, and for those of you who aren't aware of this situation, we've talked about it on Grahamian X, our subscriber show, but I'm going to delve into that here in a moment. But Art said, whoever this crazy person is, they're not stopping, and it has to come, or it has come to a point, that we as a family do not feel it is worth the risk. Now, while I think the person or persons are after me, my wife and now my daughter are really scared. The other night after the latest incident, my daughter was off in the corner of her bed, scared to death, as the police cars came screaming up. I will not put my family through this. As you all know, I dearly love what I do, but not as at the expense of never-ending terrorism. I want to thank those of you who have shown so much support, and it has been my joy, short as it has been, to have cracked that mic open for a last time. This was a family decision. The girls stuck with me and still would, but if one of them were harmed because of what I love doing, my life would be over. Art. Now, funny thing about the message I did notice in reading it is that there are certain letters that are not all caps, but he capitalizes them almost as though it had been written in a legal kind of a way. And this is just my own observation, but wife is capital W, daughter is capital D in every instance, family is in every instance capital F, and the word terrorism is capital T as well. That may or may not be of any importance here. But I noticed maybe it was just purely for the purpose of emphasis, and that certainly he was trying to lay. But this has been an ongoing problem. Now, writing over at Radio Survivor, Paul Riesmantle had reported that Keith Rowland, who runs the syndicator for Midnight in the Desert, Dark Matter Radio Network that they were using as the launch platform for ART, had said that I'm unsure of the status of the program and replacement host. That network, of course, is apparently, according to what was reported at Radio Survivor, they're offering refunds to subscribers of the Time Traveler podcast service that ART had been offering. But Bell's Midnight in the Desert program was intended to be online only, and apparently he had been picking up so much excitement that broadcast affiliates were signing on just as well. This problem had been brewing for quite a while, despite all of that. Going back to October 22nd, ART had reported at the website, or rather a post on the website had reported that during ART's live broadcast of his Midnight in the Desert radio program Wednesday night, gunshots rang out in his neighborhood. Police were called to the scene, and it was determined that a subject had driven into ART's neighborhood and fired shots near or at ART's studio. Now, as heard on the broadcast of that show, ART had interrupted his guest at that time. He began playing music while he had gone outside to investigate the situation. He returned on the air, completed the interview and his program, and after the show, he had subsequently posted at the Facebook page, "Okay, police just left for the second time. The girls are asleep, so here's what I can tell you. At about 10:33 Pacific time, I got a text from my close neighbor saying he'd heard four or five fast shots that seemed near my studio. He thought they were from the street behind the house, but did not see anything. And then a moment later, another neighbor texted me, and she heard the shots and saw a car in the dead-end lane in front of my studio, which fired four or five rifle shots at or near the house, and then they took off in a mid-sized car. We will check for bullet holes in the daylight. The girls turned off all the lights and hugged the floor. We're all okay, but a bit freaked out. We have video cameras, but not recorded, and that will change. Sorry for the scare, but it was worse on this end." And so apparently, in lieu of these events and the continuation of these events, it had been a family decision that ART would end his radio career. This time, they're saying for good. I guess, of course, a lot of people are asking, well, how is stopping the show going to stop this sort of violence? Who would not want you on the radio? Who would be harassing you to the tune of firing a rifle from your driveway? We don't have the answer to these kind of things. I certainly know if someone were doing it to me, the first thing I would probably do is contact the authorities, which ART did. Second thing I would do would be consider moving far, far away. Maybe he hopes to do that, but that's not the kind of thing anyone wants to have to do, especially after having moved out of the country and then coming back to the United States, getting his studio built, going through the whole thing with Sirius, you know, canning that deal, waiting, relaunching, and now having to make this decision. It is troubling. And of course, then there are the rebroadcasts that are issued on Premier Radio Networks on Saturday nights somewhere in time, but a totally different kind of time that I want to touch on here. Jack Dickey, writing in September of 2013, for Time magazine, had actually recalled some of his favorite experiences with ART. He'd gone out and he'd actually done an article with ART, and this was leading up to the launch of what was to be the Sirius radio program. He wrote, "Many, many people have missed ART Bell. Take it not from the now-defunct streaming sites or his busy Facebook page or the chirping at the Fantastic Forum. Just look at the numbers. Sirius XM has a broad user base. The satellite radio provider has 25 million subscribers overall. But Bell's used to the biggest of numbers. Coast to Coast was syndicated to over 500 North American stations by the end of his run. He spoke to 10 to 15 million listeners per week, fourth among all talk show hosts of the era, despite broadcasting from 1 a.m. to 6 a.m. Eastern. His Marlboro Lights weathered voice blanketed the continent after dark, reliably chilling his audience of insomniacs, truckers, night shift workers, and whoever else might be alone with a radio late at night." But Dickey had noted in his article, and actually, there was one that went in print, which was pretty significant when you're talking about a host in this genre to be featured in Time magazine. But there was also a blog post at the Time website where Dickey noted that ART Bell had become something of a cultural phenomenon. National media outlets, including Time, blamed him as part of the Heaven's Gate cult's mass suicide back in 1997. and this was because the cult leader had said its members would be able to board a mysterious craft supposedly trailing the Hale-Bopp comet if they killed themselves, and at least two of Bell's guests had reported seeing such a UFO. Now, he discredited their stories afterward, but not in time to avoid some scientists' wrath. And Bell's not infrequent retirements, Dickey noted, motivated the family turmoil. His son had, you know, apparently been molested by a teacher, and then two shortwave radio hosts accused him of the crime. That was awful. That ensured that he would draw only more attention. When he returned to the air full-time in 2001 and said it was for good, he lasted only a year and a half longer before taking on a part-time load. More personal misfortune followed. His third wife, Ramona, died of an asthma attack while they were vacationing in the couple's RV, and then 3 months later, Bell moved to the Philippines to marry Aaron, a college student, 39 years his junior, and they together had a daughter, Asia, who's now six. So, at the time that Dickey wrote the article, he had mentioned, now he returns. Old Coast hand Michio Kaku, the theoretical physicist, will be his first guest, and Ross Mitchell, the Old Coast announcer, will do Bell's intro and bumpers. And Dickey said, I asked Bell what he'd do on this show that he didn't do enough of on the old show, and he says he's really eager to talk about life after death. That's what Dickey wrote back in 2013, although I have to say it's ironic now, I suppose, rather than life after death, we're talking about death after life, at least as far as Art's broadcasting ventures appear to be concerned. So we wish him the best, and of course hope for the continued safety of he and his family, no matter what's happening right there. But that's not the only bigwig in radio that's making headlines this week. You know, this Wednesday, December 16th, apparently is going to be Howard Stern's final show. Okay, well, at least under the 5-year contract he has with Sirius, former home of Art Bell. What is he going to do next remains a mystery. Nobody really knows. He could walk away from the medium, which he actually once did. He might try his hand at internet radio. You know, some people have been asking, however, if indeed he might try other things, which we'll get to in a moment. Over the past year, it's been reported, Stern has claimed to have had at least one tempting offer, though he declined to name the suitor. In the meantime, his fans provided plenty of ideas on what he should do next. And among them, people have said clearly he should join Apple, or Google, or Pandora, or Spotify, or all of the above. In other words, you should just do a podcast. And he says that he is open to almost any scenario except podcasting. And this is what Howard Stern says, I quote, if you want to be in radio, forget a podcast. Podcasts are for losers. No, I guess, Howard, they're not for losers. Maybe he's just the last of a dying breed. I don't know. I don't really see it being the end of radio. But even Art, when he relaunched, was focusing on podcasting and internet radio. There will be a market for radio, but I think that the podcasting medium has absolutely changed. It hasn't overthrown, but it has certainly changed the medium. And I always bristle a bit when I hear radio hosts saying podcasting is for losers. It's funny that there are more and more radio shows who offer their programs after they broadcast as podcasts. Why? Because people can listen on demand. And yes, in truth, that is part of why I have been so interested in podcasting over the years and even wrote a book about this, which I've talked about on this program. But anyway, so who knows? The state of radio may indeed be in strange times, if nothing else, with the departure of Art Bell and Howard Stern within a week of one another. But then again, we're assuming Howard's going to be back. Perhaps on Wednesday he'll announce where he intends to go. Right now things remain in a state of flux, kind of as we are right now with a lot of things. You know, our eventual aspirations as far as getting to the red planet of Mars, and of course the ongoing discussion of whether or not we're all going to be killed by evil robots. That is, of course, as long as we survive the continued issue of terrorism. Boy, we're hitting all the red buttons tonight, aren't we? So Elon Musk and apparently a group of other tech giants have just launched a $1 billion fund to do just that. No, not to try and thwart terrorism, but to make sure that robots won't thwart us. Mr. Musk, it's been reported by The Independent in the UK, has repeatedly warned about the dangers of artificial intelligence, calling AI the biggest threat to humanity. A range of other famous scientists and technologists have warned about the same, including, of course, as we've discussed numerous times on this program, Stephen Hawking. The newly launched company is called OpenAI and will make use of huge sets of data to build artificially intelligent robots that won't end up killing humans. And OpenAI's goal, as stated, is, quote, to advance digital intelligence in the way that is most likely to benefit humanity as a whole, unconstrained by a need to generate financial return. The new company hopes it can work against too many big companies already, like Google or Facebook, but both of which have huge artificial intelligence operations just as well. And they hope to try and network and prevent anyone getting too much power from super intelligence systems. Governments may also use the power of AI, it is believed, to oppress the citizens, as the backers of OpenAI have warned. The company is being funded by Elon Musk as well as a range of other backers. These include Y Combinator, a startup funding program that has stakes in some of the biggest technology companies around. Now, I have to say, in the past, I like Elon Musk, but in the past I've been, if not critical, I've certainly been unimpressed with what Elon has had to say about artificial intelligence. I mean, it's true, and I think that that's a warranted statement. And I'll give you an idea of exactly why I feel that way. Going all the way back to, I suppose this probably would have been around June of 2014, he was asked during a panel discussion on a television broadcast about his interest in investing in artificial intelligence, at which time he said the following.
Now, I have to ask you about a company that you invested in. You, as you said, you make almost no investments outside of SpaceX.
Yeah, I'm not really an investor.
You're not an investor.
I don't own any public securities apart from SolarCity and Tesla.
That's amazing. But you did just invest in a company called Vicarious Artificial Intelligence. What is this company?
Right. I was also an investor in DeepMind before Google acquired it and Vicarious. It's not from the standpoint of actually trying to make any investment return. I'd like to just keep an eye on what's going on with artificial intelligence. I think there's potentially a dangerous outcome there, and we need to.
Dangerous.
Potentially, yes.
So?
I mean, there's been movies about this, you know, like Terminator.
Yes, but movies are. Even if that's the case, what do you do about it? I mean, what dangers do you see that you can actually do something about?
I don't know.
Well, why did you invest in Vicarious? What exactly does Vicarious do? What do you see it doing down the line?
Well, I mean, the Vicarious refers to it as recursive cortical networks, essentially emulating the human brain. So I think.
So you want to make sure.
So at this point, it begins to be clear. Maybe he's not entirely sure exactly what's going on. I mean, I think that he has certainly kind of clarified that argument, as we'll see here in a moment. In months since, because we're looking at only a year or two ago. But at the time, I guess I would have had to tell Mr. Musk perhaps he would benefit from some public speaking lessons. We continue.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure that technology is used for good and not Terminator-like evil?
Yeah. I mean, in the movie Terminator, they didn't create AI to, in order, I mean, they didn't expect, some sort of Terminator-like outcome. It's sort of, you know, like that Monty Python thing. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition. It's just like, it's, you know, but you got to be careful. So you want to make sure that.
But here's the irony. I mean, the man.
It's almost as though the anchors are having to kind of fill in the blanks for him. I mean, he was definitely stumbling, and I thought maybe he just had a bad day. You know, to his credit, maybe he just had a bad day. Then we have the following audio from just a few months later.
I'm curious, your interest in the far future humanity, when did that begin? How did that start?
Well, I think it was when my interest in the future of humanity is, I guess, as a function of reading a lot of sci-fi and philosophy as a kid, and then just sort of thinking about, okay, what's important to do, like why do anything? What's the meaning of life? And you know, I came to the conclusion that what we really need to do is make sure that life continues into the future, and particularly conscious life.
I'm sorry, I just was not really impressed with what he had to say, and I kind of remain that way. He's a brilliant guy. He is really on the top of his game, and he is truly an innovator. But, you know, again, in terms of what he has actually had to say as a commentator, in fairness, I would say that I read the threads on videos posted of Musk online, and people are like, wow, this guy's my new role model. I'm like, why? You can't really make out exactly what he's saying. There's a lot of ums, yeah. But he did kind of tighten things up. This was, I think, at an MIT panel. And at one point, someone actually in the audience stood up and asked him about artificial intelligence. This was, I think, the most declarative and clear statement made by Musk on this. And right now, I, in fairness, people know what he's trying to say. But if you're going to be the spokesperson for the dangers, the potential dangers of artificial intelligence, if that's going to be the cause that you champion, you know, you do need to be able to articulate what you're trying to get across a bit more clearly. And I think he's polished things up, as this statement from earlier this year seems to indicate.
I'm going to get through a bunch of questions. I'm going to answer, make my answer short.
Okay. Hi, my name is Bob. In view of its potential to be possibly the biggest game changer ever, do you have any plans to enter the field of artificial intelligence? And in general, what are your thoughts on it? Do you think it's even close to being ready for prime time?
I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is, it's probably that. So we need to be very careful with artificial intelligence. I'm increasingly inclined to think that there should be some regulatory oversight at the national and international level, just to make sure that we don't do something very foolish. With artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon. You know all those stories where there's the guy with the pentagram and the holy water, and he's like, yeah, you sure you can control the demon? Didn't work out.
I take it there will be no Hell 9000 going up to Mars.
Hell 9000 would be easy. It's way more complex than, it would put Hell 9000 to shame. Yeah.
I do see where he's coming from. You know, he may not be exactly the perfect spokesman for the anti-AI argument. I don't think he's really trying to argue against AI. I think he's concerned about people flippantly going about the production of artificial intelligence without regard for the possible concerns that may arise further on down the road for humankind. And I completely agree with Musk on that point. We've just got to be very clear in what our feelings and thoughts are about this. And I think that really it's going to take more than just Elon Musk. But this is a gentleman who, among others, is putting $1 billion behind trying to ward off the threat of eventual AI. Interesting stuff in interesting times. And we will continue our discussion of time and interesting things here when we return on the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. Welcome back. You know, on the heels of the discussion we were having in the last segment about Elon Musk, one really, really important point that I think he has made, and this has less to do with artificial intelligence, Elon Musk at present is quite concerned that if we don't hurry up and get to Mars, that we may miss our opportunity. He's actually concerned that with the volatility that we see geopolitically right now, we could be looking at the potential for, and I guess it's always been there, and always will be there, a World War III, or any other kind of a world war. The last thing we need, if we are hoping to further mankind's presence in space and out there in the cosmos, is another global conflict. And I really think that Elon Musk is absolutely right when he talks about the fact that we need to recognize the moment in which we exist as an opportunity. And unfortunately, with the concerns that are presented by the terrorism problem that we're seeing right now, and of course, other geopolitical concerns, we have to be realistic about the idea that indeed we have a narrow window right now. Technology, if a global conflict were to occur, of course, technological innovation is what drives war. I mean, that is just the truth. You know, the victors are always going to be those who have the most resources and the best technology. During the Second World War, of course, some of the technologies that we observed ranged from radar to early night vision, guided missiles, of course, and rocketry was really among the technologies that the Germans had really innovated during the Second World War. Some would maintain that behind the scenes there were other technologies being innovated. You know, I think that there was an early kind of a laser technology that the Germans had been innovating. And of course, as far as encrypted technology and the kind of secret war waging that is placed in the hands of spies and intelligence networks, that, of course, came to fruition on an unprecedented scale, an absolutely unprecedented scale in comparison with the old ways of waging war. And technology is what drives the wartime innovations, and of course, eventually in the longest, you know, in the greater scheme of things, it really determines the victors. And so, if conflict erupts, technological attention, I guess, is focused in a lot of ways toward the war effort, which is disconcerting. And for people like Elon Musk, you know, whether or not he's able to necessarily articulate his concerns well, he's looking at the potential for future conflict, whether that be with conflict between humans or humans and some other form of intelligence, manufactured or perhaps alien in nature. These are possibilities, and people can roll their eyes with these kind of things, but, I mean, that's one thing that Elon Musk is absolutely on top of, is he is certainly looking at this as being, listen, potential problems, folks, that we may have to deal with. And whether or not AI comes along, we may not be able to get along well enough that technological innovation will be able to be remaining in terms of its focus on our attempts at trying to further ourselves as a species. And I hope, like Elon, that the furtherance of our technological presence in positive ways will be the ultimate focus rather than having to focus on attacking one another, as history has shown time and time again in the past. Now, moving on to another subject, there's another one of a conspiratorial nature that's really been making headlines recently. And, you know, to paraphrase this, I think I'm going to refer to an article that my buddy Paul Seaburn over at Mysterious Universe had written over the weekend. And yes, this has to do with filmmaker Stanley Kubrick and a video that was first brought to my attention by Beth Arzy. And there is apparently a filmmaker, not Kubrick, but a filmmaker who has released transcripts, as Paul wrote at Mysterious Universe, from his upcoming documentary about Stanley Kubrick, recorded just a few days before his death, which implies that Stanley had admitted to filming a fake moon landing and forced his fellow filmmaker to keep the admission hidden from the public for 15 years. The documentary, apparently, that this filmmaker is hoping to make is titled Shooting Stanley Kubrick and was created by filmmaker T. Patrick Murray. Murray claims that Kubrick, who was notorious for avoiding interviews, granted him one on March 4, 1999, purportedly to discuss the soon-to-be-released Eyes Wide Shut and the rest of his large body of work, but instead fueled by Johnny Walker Blue, Kubrick appears to confess to having perpetrated a fraud. And yes, of course, we're talking about faking the moon landings. I gotta be honest, I didn't even bother to watch this video when it was first sent to me, because we hear about these moon landing fakes all the time. And, I finally thought, it being show day, I would take a look at the video, and I was remarkably unimpressed with what I saw. I had noted that others had already been saying that they weren't really sure that this was Stanley Kubrick, and I think that was something even that Beth had pointed out. It doesn't appear really to be him in the footage. But the footage, let's just give it the benefit of the doubt for the time being. I'm going to let you hear exactly the kind of thing that is said in this footage, which shows in a very kind of dark, contrasty environment, you know, a close-up shot of this fellow that looks sort of like Kubrick did toward the end of his life. And he just starts rattling off without being prompted about this faking of the moon landing.
At first, I was just blown away by the chance, the opportunity, the challenge of making this film. And I went into it like it was a regular film, like another production of mine. Not thinking too much about the long-term effects, the what it would mean to society if it was ever discovered.
Mm-hmm. What are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about. You're referring to something.
The moon, the fake moon landing.
The rumor about the fake moon landing. You're saying is not a rumor or not is not an urban legend. You're saying it's true.
I'm sorry. I thought you knew that.
But, I didn't. I mean, I've heard it like anyone else has heard it, but you.
I'm sorry. Stop the press. Hold the phone. Hold on. Is this guy who's interviewing Kubrick, is he drunk?
I mean, I've never even heard of it. Moon landing, huh?
I mean, seriously, it's so bad. Listen to that. He sounds like he's like, he is terribly inebriated.
It was fake.
Wait, okay. And I thought, okay, I have written down, and I thought you agreed to talk about Barry Lyndon. You agreed to talk about The Killing, Clockwork Orange. I mean, we're going to cover all these films.
Maybe he just has a speech impediment. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't be accusing him. Nah, I think he's just drunk.
And I hope we still can, but what you're telling me, because I've never heard, I think it would make the news if you're telling me now for the first time, and why me? Why not CNN?
See, that's the first problem I had with this video. So you show up for the interview of your lifetime. Stanley Kubrick agrees to sit down and talk to you, and you show up plastered for the interview. You are plastered. You are beyond. This guy was on Mars. To hell with moon landing fake. He was on Mars when this interview was being done. Yeah. Yeah, he was remote viewing the entire thing, apparently.
The rumors were true.
Okay, well, I obviously want to understand what the hell you're what you're talking about here. Okay, but why are you telling me? I'm a nobody.
The moon landings were fake.
Okay, and I want to hear what the hell you're saying. I don't know. Tell me how, what, when, where. I'd like to hear the story about this, but...
Someone get this drunk man out of the building! I mean, seriously, it's so bad. So, I kept watching. I don't know why. I like to punish myself sometimes. I do it for you guys. You know, I push myself through some of this stuff so that I can bring you the news so that you don't have to do the kind of laborious show prep that I do on a weekly basis. And I kid you not, hours and hours and hours go into every program. But if you listen to the rest of this video, I mean, it's obvious that this entire thing was staged. I'm going to play a clip for you that's from maybe 3 or 4 minutes ahead, further on down the audio clip. You'll hear, first of all, that the announcer, I don't know if he's like pretending to be drunk or just shocked, or if by pretending to sound shocked, he sounds drunk. Later, you'll hear his voice clears up very quickly, especially when he's giving orders to the actor who is portraying Kubrick, as you're about to hear right here, and coaching him on what to say in front of the camera.
Okay, so tell me a story. This is where you're going to tell the story of Nixon and his men coming to you and saying, Stanley, we tried our best. But Gus just died on the plane. We can't get those boys up there safely. You got to help us. You said no. And they kept pleading about that. Patriotism, Russia, the boys. We'll get there in a couple years. Funding, you know, the shtick. And I decided, okay. And then you got the gift from God, you know, a carte blanche filmmaking. So right. Just tell that story now and try to give it details. You know, right. Little ones as they come up. Okay, boom. Now, so tell me. So you're saying it's impossible. Could you give me a list of reasons why it's impossible? Cut. I'm going to do a voiceover there, okay?
Okay, so just so that,
I'm going to give you something, and you're going to be like, boom, and boom, and boom, and you're going to sound like you're an expert. So it's going to be
okay.
Cool.
All right. Okay,
I don't, okay. I really don't see how people were watching this, and it wasn't obvious that this was either... I don't think it was necessarily a hoax, and in all fairness to the filmmaker, whatever they were trying to do, this very well may be art. I mean, this very well may be something that was intentionally staged. You know, that happens from time to time. But the problem I have, rather than being with the filmmakers, or the person perpetrating, you know, himself as being Stanley Kubrick in the footage, the problem I have is the people who watch something like this and go, see, there it is, I told you! I think it gets into the realm of being wish fulfillment a lot of the time for people. It really does. People hear what they want to hear. They see what they want to see. And if someone already believes that Kubrick had been involved in hoaxing the moon landing, you know, for NASA or for whoever else, whoever it might have been that had asked him to participate in this, the greatest fraud of all time, if you believe that, sadly, there are many people who, they don't go around looking to try and disprove their belief. They're only looking for information that confirms their opinion from the outset. This is generally what people do, and they do it on both sides. You know, a person who is... I'll tell you what, a great example of what I'm talking about, even better than this moon landing thing, although I do want to come back to that, because we've got a little bit more audio. I almost said idiot. That would have been a real Freudian slip, but anyway, there's a little more audio here. But a great example of what I'm talking about here, about wish fulfillment and confirmation bias as it relates to a subject, is this entire debate surrounding the escape of Adolf Hitler. which has really been renewed because of the History Channel program called Hunting Hitler. And, you know, we devoted the entire Grayling X podcast. I thought it was a really, really, really good show because, first of all, my father, who's been on this program before, and people always email, they always love it when he comes on. Dad's a real scholar. This man can speak numerous languages. He holds a double major in history and classics and also part of a master's degree. He is an active Episcopal priest, but he is probably one of the deepest philosophical thinkers that I know, frankly. And he's very well-rounded in his learning with regard to classics and history. And you know, he's just a wonderful person to have a kind of conversation like this with, because rather than trying to make a strong case for Hitler's escape in the conversation that Grayling X listeners were treated to over the weekend, he outlines what is required in order to be able to effectively rewrite the history books. Then he says, now this is the evidence that we have. And then, somewhat playing devil's advocate, I actually refer to the conventional historical narrative. I still find problems with it, and I outline those point by point chronologically, but nonetheless maintain a perspective throughout the conversation that we have, as though Hitler had died in the bunker and we could take that as fact, which most historians do. But the interesting takeaway from the conversation, which I can't give all the details about, obviously we want subscribers to be able to check this out without giving all of the details away, but one point that I will make right here that is really important about all this is that I find that even if you accept that Hitler died by committing suicide in the bunker as the Russians were closing in, what we can still learn from this experience is that the conventional historical narrative is riddled with problems. And I think that mainstream historians, including John Toland, who had written the definitive biography of Hitler in the early 1970s, even he details a number of these in the epilogue. And what's fascinating to me is that with what little evidence they have to confirm Hitler's death, which is almost entirely based on his dental record, you know, a bridge and a jaw fragment that was compared with x-rays taken of the Führer's head following the assassination attempt at the Wolf's Den, which the film Valkyrie starring Tom Cruise is based on. Those comparisons are how the determination was made. Now, in the United States, it was all made based on photographs of those samples and those x-rays. The comparison was made by UCLA professor Sonya, I believe was his name, in 1968. When you look at the Russian files, it's fascinating because at first they say that he had taken a cyanide capsule and that fragments were found in the mouth of the body of what was believed to be Hitler. That was later refuted. They exhumed the body. They had to send a skull fragment back to Stalin because of testimony given by Nazis that had been in the bunker at the time who said that he had committed suicide by shooting himself. In 2009, University of Connecticut, scientists are given less than an hour, but they managed to take a sample, and DNA testing on that sample of the alleged skull fragment determines it was that of a woman between the ages of 20 and 40, not, of course, Adolf Hitler's skull. Now, Russia maintains it does belong to Hitler despite the science. Oh, science be damned. It's Hitler. But there are a lot of problems with this story. And even if we accept that Hitler died in the bunker, there are still a lot of problems with the story, especially problems with the way that the Russians handled all this. And even mainstream historians acknowledge that. That doesn't prove he got to Argentina. What would prove it? Well, we'd need a hell of a lot of evidence. But what's interesting is that you'll find that even if you were to present that kind of evidence, I maintain that there would be conventional historical perspectives, or the perspectives among those who maintain the status quo, who would still argue it. Why? Because they are beholden to the belief. They feel, and it's not that they're trying to say, well, evidence be damned, but people are very stubborn when it comes to being presented new information, even if the information should seemingly and conclusively upturn our opinions and ideas. By the same token, the best evidence in favor of the historical narrative will never do well enough for certain conspiracy theorists who, by virtue of their worldview, I think, are always seeking an alternative answer. In other words, no matter what you tell me, no matter how good the evidence, I will be able to show you some way this could have been hoaxed and that the wool could have been proverbially pulled over our eyes. And see, with this moon landing thing, again, it's impossible, of course, for us to have gone to the moon. Some of the, I guess what you might call conspiracy light thinkers would maintain, well, yeah, we probably eventually went to the moon, but the moon landing, the footage was faked. That was faked to give the Russians the impression that we'd gotten there sooner than we actually did, but we did eventually go. Others maintain a much more staunch and skeptical position. We could not go into space. It's impossible the Van Allen radiation belts would prevent it. That at one time was believed. But, you know, in his book, The NASA Conspiracies, even Nick Redfern, and I say that as though Nick is someone who, you know, panders a lot of foolishness or something. I don't mean that at all. In fact, Nick actually is one of the, in my opinion, in a lot of instances, a more well-grounded researcher with a lot of the determinations that he puts out there in his books. And he's surprised me many times with some of the things that he's said and some of the facts that he's brought to my attention. But in The NASA Conspiracies, he absolutely, absolutely maintains, you know, there is no question. We went to the moon. No, we didn't hoax the moon landing. Nick's going to be on the show next week, by the way, so maybe we'll talk with him a bit about that, as if anything else needs to be said. But there are others who have maintained, of course, that the moon landings are indeed a hoax. Maybe you've heard about this documentary. I think it's on Netflix right now, and it's called Room 237. And the theory espoused by Jay Widener in that film is that there are all of these secret messages that one sees in the film The Shining that are indicative of and tantamount to an admission by Stanley Kubrick. When we come back from this program, we'll talk about that a little bit more. I will tell you this. I have watched the documentary. I will also tell you this. I am thoroughly unimpressed with the idea that The Shining, starring Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall, that is an admission made by the late filmmaker about his complicitness in hoaxing the moon landing. But we'll talk about that when we come back here on the Graylian Report. So if the moon landings were hoax, that means I'll never get my opportunity to go and visit the moon myself, right? Ugh. Another one of my bucket list additions kicked right back out. But then again, I guess I'll just have to add, I don't know, bottom of the Mariana Trench to fill that space. Just kidding. Welcome back. So in the final segment of this hour, again, I was talking earlier about this film, Room 237. And I want to go to a bit of audio featuring Jay Widener as he explains his own perspective of the alleged Stanley Kubrick admission presented in the film as it relates to the idea of there being a cover-up of a hoaxed moon landing which the director, Stanley Kubrick, had participated in.
Richard Hoagland, the researcher, has looked into the Apollo imagery and he has found all sorts of problems with it because in the sky around the astronauts, he's found reflecting lights and refracting things and kind of a junk and geometry and things that are in the sky. And he concluded, wrongly, that there are gigantic alien cities made out of glass. What he's really saying is the reflections of light off the tiny beads on the Scotch light screen, which is being used in the front screen projection process. And so once I nailed the front screen projection process inside the Apollo footage, then I became interested in seeing if Kubrick left any clues in the rest of his career to his possible involvement in faking the Apollo moon footage. And I was overjoyed about 2 years ago when I received my Blu-ray copy of The Shining. And I put it in my Blu-ray machine and sat down one night to watch it. And I realized that all of the things that one could imagine that Stanley Kubrick would have had to go through to fake the Apollo moon footage. And there in the movie, every time that Stanley deviated from the Stephen King novel, he deviated into those exact questions. What was it like to make a deal with the U.S. government? What was it like to accidentally tell someone what you were doing and to watch them possibly have to suffer the consequences of your lack of integrity. What was it like to lie to your wife and tell her that you were doing one thing when you were doing another? What was it like when your wife found out what you were really doing? These are the questions that I had long before I'd seen The Shining again after maybe an 8 or 9 year absence. And I wasn't sure I was right for the first hour. I wasn't sure that I had actually, I wasn't sure if I was blurring the line between what I wanted to see and what I was seeing. And then at about 58 minutes in the film is the famous scene where Danny's playing with his trucks and he stands up and he's wearing the Apollo 11 sweater with a rocket taking off. Then I knew I had nabbed it. And then I started watching the film with an intensity that I don't think I've ever watched a movie before. And every line began ringing true. Wendy, that is just so typical of you. Don't you know I have obligations to my employers? Do you have any idea what a contract is? Do you know what an agreement is? Jack Nicholson's whole tirade against his wife, that's Stanley. That's Stanley telling his wife that, after she discovered what he was doing, which was the Apollo footage.
Yeah, I see. I get it now. It all makes sense. Yes, everything that Jack Nicholson says to Shelley Duvall in The Shining is an admission from Stanley Kubrick about the moon landing. I got it. I mean, it just makes all the sense in the world. It's incredible, in fact, how much sense it makes. I will give him this, by the way. You know, when Danny stands up, when Danny stands up and he's wearing the Apollo 11 shirt, I'll give him that. That was kind of cool that they fit the Apollo 11 launch into the film. I don't know if that really necessarily meant anything, and frankly, I have to play on the side of Team Non-Conspiracy for this one. I don't think the moon landings were faked. Sorry, Flat Earth Society. And that's not Stanley Kubrick in that footage from earlier, either. We're going to shift gears to missing person cases when we return here on The Grillion Report. Stay with us. Welcome back. It is the second hour of tonight's edition of the program. I remain Micah Hanks, and this is The Grillion Report. Glad, as always, to be on here with you guys as we continue our foray into Fortiana and all things unusual, as well as those which are insightful just as well. For a little more insight from those of us here in the Hollow Earth, of course, you can always head on over to GrillionReport.com/X. Check out Grillion X for additional podcasts and monthly specials. And of course, also, we have a daily news roundup, a free service to the public, brought to you in part by the fine folks here at Grillion International, as well as our newsies. Mark Brady's been on vacation for a while, and so Jan and our wonderful friend Lindsay Morrison have been working extra hard, as well as Adam Olson and a few others out there, some of whom prefer to go unnamed, but they will not be unmentioned, even if I can't mention them in names. That's right, even you unmentionable Grillion newsies out there, we appreciate all that you guys do to help put out a lot of news and content on this program. Thank you to all you guys. And of course, if you are one who has news you'd like to send along, info@grillionreport.com is the way to do that. Or you could do like Beth Arzee does, and you can send along news tips as well as great music that we feature on the podcast from time to time. So, here it is around the holidays. I think to kind of ease into the next segment, you know, something that I guess we all look forward to around the holidays is being with those that we love. And, you know, coming back, I guess, to the situation with Art Bell choosing to remove himself from a situation that is apparently volatile. Again, there are a lot of questions about that. And I won't get into the politics again about whether or not leaving the air, choosing to retire for good, is really going to remove him from the apparent threat that he's describing. But especially right here on the holidays, I can certainly tell you I wouldn't want to have to go through that kind of stress. I don't think anybody would. And when the holidays come around, and it's all about being with those that you care for the very most, you know, I've been working on a project, a new writing project, that will deal with some disappearances. This is a recurring theme on this program, mysterious disappearances, people who vanish. And when we gather together around the holidays, you know, in that spirit of camaraderie and family and togetherness, you know, there's nothing worse, I think, that one can imagine in most cases than someone you care about vanishing. And that's one reason I think that I've decided to focus on that with an upcoming writing project. Now, there are a lot of people who have written about this sort of thing already, and probably most famous in the modern era is David Pilates, who focuses on disappearances in the national parks. At least one of his books has focused on other phenomena outside the United States, as well as, of course, outside of national parks, but primarily the focus here being in North America and beyond. So all parts of the world, not just North America outside of the national parks. I figured that if the kind of trends that David Pilates began to spot indeed were consistent from case to case in a lot of instances, this would have to go beyond just national parks in the United States. And so, of course, I see him kind of expanding the idea. And then another book focuses on the idea of taking the trends that have emerged and putting together the proverbial puzzle pieces. That installment, I believe, is called The Devil's in the Details. So, again, you know, looking at those kinds of disappearances is one thing, but there are a lot of different circumstances under which disappearances occur. One of the most researched that I've been involved with over the years has, of course, been the disappearance of Frederick Valentich in 1978. He was flying an aircraft over the Bass Strait, and it was shortly before nightfall. And as the sun's setting, he, of course, begins to describe to Melbourne air traffic control operators that there's a green light, apparently attached to some sort of object, and it's zooming around him and doing all kinds of interesting things. And having lectured on this, you know, having gotten to know Rhonda Rushton, who was Freddie's girlfriend at the time he went missing, there are a lot of things about this case that I haven't seen reported elsewhere that I've learned, and I think a lot of details that should be examined more closely. You know, there was, of course, the squadron that disappeared over the Florida Keys. Well, actually, technically, it was over the Bermuda Triangle, Flight 19, if memory serves. And one independent investigation that is very seldom spoken of in relation to that case where an entire fleet of aircraft went missing shortly after the Second World War. There is one thread of information involving that case that suggests that the aircraft didn't disappear over the ocean at all. That's pretty fascinating stuff. Anyway, there are a lot of different cases that don't just involve planes going missing. You know, plenty of people have written about that in an entire book. Probably several volumes could be written just on planes that go missing. I mean, MH370. Over the weekend, we had new headlines with MH370. I mean, the latest theory with regard to that plane going down and, you know, apparently going missing thereafter involves an electrical failure that may have occurred on board the aircraft. And I've been in touch with some of the listeners in the audience here, and there's a lot of skepticism about that. And even with the electrical failure theory, it is possible that human action on board that plane could have led to that. And I am probably of the mind, like many others, that there was some sort of an intentional action that took place. Whether or not that was intended to take down a plane or cause it to vanish, I think that human action almost unquestionably came into play with regard to the MH370 disappearance. And outside the realm of disappearing planes, there are also disappearances that occur in far stranger circumstances than a person going missing in the forest. I would think that really with national parks and whatnot, and this isn't to diminish the importance of the research that David Pilates offers. I think that, you know, he certainly is very open-minded to unconventional sources underlying these disappearances, and while he's very intentionally and respectfully even vague about what he thinks those things may be. Many people assert UFOs and Bigfoot and things like this. I can't help but feel that maybe David thinks that these could be explanations for some of the cases just as well, but I will point out, as he well knows and has said before in his books, that of course, you know, it is a wilderness area presented by national parks, which is of course, especially even for a experienced hiker, let alone a person who might just be an occasional weekend enthusiast and may not have all kinds of experience out in the wild, it is a national park where a person is perhaps most likely to become disoriented, lost, and then, of course, succumb to the elements, or any number of other things, dehydration, and, of course, the kind of disorientation that often accompanies the onset of such conditions. So, I think it's very clear that when we're talking about disappearances in the national parks, there are a lot of prosaic reasons why these things can happen. And this is one of the important things about these books, is that whatever you actually assert may be the underlying cause for the disappearances, I don't think that there's just one or two things. I think that there are a variety of circumstances that contribute, which in some instances do include kidnappings and the kind of things that really constitute the worst nightmares of any parent or any kind of a loved one. This is something that the Missing 411 books, perhaps above all else, have really given us, is a, I think, a broader awareness of the dangers that await in recreational areas like national parks, and people need to be wary. I was watching a video online earlier today, in fact, and this video was titled, rather ambiguously, "We were walking through the forest, and I had the sense that we were being stalked." And, of course, it absolutely worked. I had to see exactly what was happening, having had, as I've talked about in the past, my own experience in a national forest where I was following what looked like a game trail with my girlfriend at the time. And about 20 yards off to my left, I see out of the corner of my eye something that doesn't seem to match the rest of the environment, doesn't look like a tree or a bush, and I turn and look and very clearly see a man in what looked like a coverall suit, the kind of thing that you might see, you know, someone working in an automotive shop wearing. And this creep, whoever it was standing there, and the minute he sees me turning and looking toward him, I get a clear shot of him, and he ducks down behind the bush. And there's nothing more unsettling in my mind, at least from my personal experience, than being in the forest in the middle of nowhere, you and just maybe one other person, and seeing somebody who sees you and does not want to be seen. Why was this person trying to hide from us? Why was this person watching us and dressed like Jason Voorhees or something? I mean, it was like something out of a horror movie. And I remember Tony and I, we ran back up the trail, just said, "Don't ask questions." And of course, she was really confused. She's like, "What's going on?" But didn't panic, but obviously was frightened because of what little I was saying about the circumstance. So having been in that situation, I watched this video, and the video earlier today was probably just about maybe even more scary and didn't have anything to do with the person stalking them. What happens is a black bear, this black bear in the video is pretty large. I would say it's at least a couple of years old. And it's exhibiting very playful kind of behavior. This bear is running alongside them and getting dangerously close and closer and closer and closer. And then it comes up beside them and it comes and it'll run a circle around them and then it'll kind of dodge off. And it's a couple of joggers who are filming this thing. I mean, well, actually, I think that the guy had a camera hooked to his forehead probably. And as he was running along, he's looking at the bear, and that's why he's able to film this thing consistently. But the two joggers are going along, and the bear keeps getting closer. And this bear, it runs up, and it's really kind of cute, except for, of course, the two gentlemen in the footage. I'm sure it wasn't cute for them, but the bear starts jumping up on trees, and he'll climb a little bit up the tree and watch, and then he'll jump down, and he'll run up alongside him again. I mean, I got the distinct impression that this bear either had become tame because people were feeding it, which you should never do. I know people who have done that. I always tell them, I know they're cute. You may love them. They act a lot like dogs, except dogs with almost like hands. Their paws are not like a typical dog's paws. I mean, they got much more flexibility with their hands, and they can actually stand up, even walk upright if they need to. And so this guy's running along, and it's pretty obvious that this bear had become tame. At first, I almost thought about distemper or some kind of a disease that might have been causing the uncharacteristic behavior. They do have a chasing instinct. And if you're moving away from a bear like that, this is one of the dangers, is they will tend to, kind of like a dog, if you take off running from a dog or if you lay down, the dog will run up to you. Bears can tend to do that just as well. Black bears especially Younger black bears can tend to act that way. They are generally not aggressive, but a mother, if it's protecting its cubs, absolutely will become aggressive. And you do have to be careful, just like any wild animal. These can be extremely dangerous creatures. Now, the one in the video, again, I watched the entire video trying to make sense of the way that the thing was acting, having had my own numerous encounters with black bears in the wild. I've had black bears charge at me briefly. That was scary, but it didn't come running up to me. It charged, snorted, and ran off. They'll often do that. It's called bluffing. And I have to say that Dwight McCarter, who wrote the book Lost, which covered, he was one of the searchers involved in the Lloyd Martin disappearance. Dwight McCarter talked about having black bears charge right up to him. Yearlings, though, younger black bears, they'll do that as a bluff. And he said, you take your staff. I would never, by the way, advise somebody try this. I don't know if I'd have the guts to do it either. But he would take his walking staff and just pop them on the nose, and he said they'd always just take off running the other way. Well, this bear, of course, is being very playful with these guys and finally kind of takes off, and as soon as it gets out of the way, these two guys go running back up the trail. They run. They don't stop. They run. They get all the way to their car, and they're just out of breath, and they couldn't believe what had happened. That certainly could have become a potentially dangerous situation. Even a black bear maybe that had not intended any harm had become tame, was looking for food. I mean, it could still cause a lot of damage. And that was obviously, without question, when you're dealing with a large wild animal, it always becomes a potentially dangerous situation. And I can't help but think that, you know, even removing kidnappings and psychos and weirdos that hang around from time to time and lurk in the wilderness, you don't need that for there to be dangers present. With black bears, bobcats, you know, coyotes, wolves, any number of different kind of animal species that can be extremely dangerous given the wrong circumstances. All of these things are the very kinds of things that hikers and outdoorsmen need to be aware of, and no doubt probably contribute to the disappearances that have occurred in national parks. But you've got some of these cases that are stranger to me, because whereas a national park is the ideal kind of a place where a person would be expected to go missing, imagine, for instance, when people, maybe a group of people who are supposed to be in a building, vanish as if they just walked right off the face of the earth. I mean, this happened back in 1900. And as a matter of fact, it was right around Christmas time. And this is a famous story. Captain James Harvey had been in charge of a ship. And it was a ship that was, in fact, carrying a replacement lifehouse keeper. And they were approaching the Flannan Isles. St. Flannan is whom it was named for. He was a 6th century Irish bishop who later became a saint. And this island's uninhabited, as far as I know, even today, but it actually being out there on the Outer Hebrides. And, of course, there was a lighthouse built on this because of the location. It doesn't have to be inhabited, but it's furthest out, I guess west out there on the Hebrides, and so it's a natural location on this outcropping on this island for the construction of a lighthouse. The Elian Moore Lighthouse was built there. And so James Harvey, on his ship, he's approaching, and he's bringing the replacement lighthouse keeper, because I think every couple of weeks they would filter through. There were two men who were on duty, one that was kind of a standby, and then they would rotate. So, December 26th, 1900, they're making their way up. They're noticing, first problem, of course, is that there are supposed to be three men in this lighthouse, and yet the light isn't apparently in operation. The ship reaches the landing platform. Harvey gets out, the captain. He's equally surprised to see that no one's waiting for them to arrive. They should have obviously seen the lights of the approaching ship, so there's no light in the house. There's no one on the landing platform awaiting them either. He blows his horn, sends up a warning flare to try and get their attention. Still no response. So Joseph Moore rides ashore. He goes up the steep set of stairs. He heads up there. Now, this was according to Moore's own reports. He said that as he was heading up the stairs, all the way up to the cliff and all the way up to the lighthouse and all the way up the spiraling stairs to the top, he says he was overtaken with an overwhelming sense of foreboding and dread. And he said that he noticed that the door was unlocked to enter the lighthouse. There was a coat rack that held three coats. Two of them were missing. He continues on into the kitchen area. He said that, according to legend, that there was half-eaten food in an overturned chair Well, the official documentation about this case does not actually mention half-eaten food, as though something had literally just come in there and whisked them away while they're having their dinner. And there's a further note that said that one of the clocks there in the kitchen had actually stopped. Well, that may have just been because there wasn't anybody on hand to wind it. But Moore continues his search throughout the lighthouse. They find no sign of the lighthouse keepers. So there was a telegram sent back to the mainland. And the telegraph read, "A dreadful accident has happened at Flannan's. The three keepers, Ducat, Marshall, and the Occasional, have disappeared from the island. On our arrival there this afternoon, no sign of life was to be seen on the island. We fired a rocket, but as no response was made, managed to land Moore, who went up to the station but found no keepers there. The clocks were stopped, and other signs indicated that the accident must have happened about a week ago. Poor fellas, they must have been blown over the cliffs or drowned trying to secure a crane or something like that. Night coming on, we could not wait to make something as to their fate. I've left Moore, MacDonald, and Buoymaster and two seamen on the island to keep the light burning until you make other arrangements. We will not return to Oban until I hear from you. I've repeated this wire to the Muirhead in case you are not at home, and I will remain at the telegraph office tonight until it closes if you wish to wire me." Sir Robert Muirhead, the board's supernatant, who both recruited and also had known the three men, departed to the island to investigate. They did find a few things, but including, by the way, there had been entries that were kept in a journal, and this is perhaps the strangest aspect of this entire case. So on the 12th of December, remember that they arrived on the 26th and found the lighthouse unattended, the two coats missing, no men in sight. Thomas Marshall, the second assistant, had written in the actual log kept at the lighthouse on the 12th of December of, quote, "severe winds, the likes of which I have never seen before in 20 years." He also notes in the document that James Ducat, the principal keeper, had been very quiet, and that the third assistant, William MacArthur, who had been a robust man, he'd been a guy who had been really known as kind of a tough type back at home, well, he'd been crying according to the log. The following day, another entry reads that the storm was still raging and that the men at this point were all praying. And then finally, on the 14th of December, it's noted that the storms have apparently moved on. What's strange about this, however, is that this, even being in the Outer Hebrides, the lighthouse should have been clearly visible from the nearby islands that actually were populated. No one reported the kind of weather that the three men in that lighthouse had reported experiencing. In fact, it was only on December 17th that any weather at all would have moved into the area, but the men recorded, of course, the 12th, 13th, and 14th, that this horrible storm was passing through. On December 15th, the only entry reads, "Storm ended, sea calm. God is over all." And that was apparently the last clue that was left in the actual log. No one knows exactly what happened at Ilha Moore, and it remains a mystery to this day. And when we come back from this break, we're going to examine another mystery that involves a missing person. But this one, as strange as the one you may have just heard, indeed seems to be, this one that you're about to hear about is one for the books. This is perhaps one of the strangest disappearances I've come across in recent times, and it only occurred about a year ago, which we will focus on when we return here on the Graylin Report.
The founding fathers won. up on Capitol Hill. They sure got a plan. I'll make my stand. I'm back in Dulcie with a gun in my hand.
Welcome back. It is the Graylian Report, Daniel Petit's song Dulce. Very fitting for the mood that we're about to ease into. So, it was only October of last year when the story that we're about to delve into really began. The air was mild and pleasant on the morning that Kenny Veach set out on what would be his final trip into the Sheep Mountains. The sky was mostly clear with a few clouds painted against the purple mountains ahead in luminous pastels. There was probably a light breeze blowing that morning, typical of an early November day in Nevada. Veach had planned to remain in the mountains for about 2 days. And according to a video uploaded to his YouTube account just days earlier on October 17th, 2014, he was somewhat familiar with the very rugged area he was about to enter. And he tells the story of his mission to do a one-day hike, and he's looking for a cave that he found. Now, having documented his journey, we will return now to Kenny's world, where he actually discusses the cave that he found and what he hoped to find.
Well, here I am on my hike up here in the mountains north of Las Vegas. This is the a canyon I just walked up in. Now you can't tell, but my truck is way out there by the mountains at the very, very end of this valley. It's kind of like a big canyon. On the other side of these mountains, I'll show you in a second, is the bombing range, the Nellis Air Force bombing range. They do a lot of practice stuff out there. This is an old mine, and there's a hole here that just goes way down. I'll show you that. And then the last time I came up here, I hiked up to the top of what they call Gas Peak, and I spent the night. It was a two-day hike, and then I hiked all the way down to another valley over here and went past this mountain range you see on my right, all the way back out to the flat desert. Now, the camera doesn't pick this up very well, but it's a long way. And I just romp around out here, do some solo hikes, and have some fun. My mission today is to just do a one-day hike. It's about a 10-hour hike. I got to still go over another ridge and then go all the way down a big crevice that's real narrow and gets kind of scary. And I'm looking for a cave that I found, and I didn't have a sidearm when I was here before, and something about that cave just spooked me. Out of all the caves I've ever gone in, this one just made my body vibrate. The closer I got to it, the crazier my body felt, and I was like, all right, I'm not going to go in there right now, but I'm coming back someday. And I talked to some people on YouTube, and I told them, hey, I'm coming out here, you know, because they kind of called my hand on it. So I don't know if there's going to be anything to it, but it might be interesting. If I can find it, I got to relocate it, and this is a big mountain range I'm in. And I'm on foot, you know. My truck's way out there. There's no roads. There's no trails. It's a pretty rough terrain. So hopefully I'll find it. It's shaped like a big M. It's a big cave that looks just like a gigantic M. And it's about as tall as I am and kind of narrow. And it's stuck on the side of a mountain. So I hope I can find it again. And if I do, I'm going in there. I'm going to put on my light and take my gun out and walk in there, see if I find anything. We'll see.
What's interesting about this story is that, again, the cave was purportedly close, according to an account that he gave in a comment on his YouTube channel. The cave that he discovered was apparently close to Nellis Air Force Base, and he described it as being one of the strangest things that ever happened to him, the discovery of that cave. Now, whatever the disturbance had been, whether real or imagined, which he described of his encounter at this location, it prompted him to return, and of course carrying, as Daniel Petit's song read, a gun in his hand, or at very least on his side. When Kenny Veach returned to the area in hopes of finding the cave, this time he brought with him a 9mm handgun. And that, of course, because whatever it was about the cave that he had felt, it disturbed him. Now, the video is still available on YouTube, and if you do a search for M, like the letter M, cave hike, you can actually find that video. It's about a half hour long, and he breaks down all of the data that he has about this location, which he, in the video, documents his way along as he goes back trying to find the cave again. He was unable to find it. And it is believed he didn't vanish and lose his camera or anything like that. He comes back from this trip, unable to find the cave. The following month in November, the video being made in October, he goes back again. It is believed he was looking for the cave, which he failed to find the first time. Part of what motivates him to go back again, get this, seemed to have been the fact that there were internet trolls, okay, who, as he says, were calling his hand on the story. And he was pretty frustrated at the fact that this eerie cave, shaped like the letter M, which he was unable to find again, but which had frightened him badly, so badly the first time that he refused to enter without a firearm to explore it. It was beginning to get to him, and he really wanted to find this cave, so he sets off again to try and find it, and never comes back. At this point, we'll return again to Kenny's own commentary, because throughout the video, which would have been the last video that he ever made in the area, he really gives some unique perspective on the lay of the land. He's not hiking on a trail. And most important, there's very little, if any, sign of people in this area.
Okay, so I'm back. I came down one mountain. I came over a ridge and I dropped down inside this canyon. Now, that's actually behind me. I'm actually going. There's big mountains over there. There's a few caves over there, but that's not where I found it. Out that direction is the direction I'm heading down here. I'll walk a little bit. So I'm in another long canyon. This is the second canyon, and I had to go over a small mountain to get to this one and then drop down. And I just got down here, and now this is just going to go all the way down through this whole twisty, windy canyon, and I've got to follow it, and it gets real narrow, and then it starts turning into cliffs and stuff that I got to start climbing down. It gets a little hairy, but I've done it two other times, so I know I can get through. And then it just drops down out into the flat desert. All of a sudden, boom, you're out of the mountains and you're on the desert. And then I got to walk the whole range all the way back, and it is a long way. So I'm gonna be worn out, but that beer is gonna taste good. So along here, I'm sure it's further down this canyon, and see, I gotta go past that mountain way out there and then just keep on going. It turns into a real narrow canyon. So this is the kind of terrain I hike over all the time. No trails, no trash, no people. I'm sure there's mountain lions out here. And all kinds of other critters. No bears, obviously, there's no bears out here. And I've never run into a rattlesnake, which is kind of strange. But there's, as you can see, there's no water out here. So, there's a bird. Oh, I missed him. He's making noises. I wish I could get a picture of him. So I take photographs of cool stuff. I find fossils and all kinds of stuff. So that's where I came from, way back over there. I had to drop down off of that mountain. And now I got a ways to go down here. So I'm going to turn this off. And if I find the cave, I'll be turning it back on. Bye-bye.
As remote as the area is, of course, he's also describing the fact that the area where he is particularly dangerous. And you almost cringe a few times as he's including the segments of the video. He'll stop filming and he'll begin again. And in a couple of instances, as he's walking along filming, he cringes and says, "Ouch, you know, I just twisted my ankles, I'm walking." As if every step he takes could be his last.
Here's the mountain. There's another range I'm walking down. I'll just give you an idea how long it takes to get past these mountains. You know, so I just keep on walking. I'm kind of going down. I'm in a big giant creek bed right now. And I haven't come to the area where the cave is. So it's along here somewhere. This is going to get real narrow way down here when I finally get up to that mountain down there, which is it's a good distance away. When I get to that mountain, I should be in the narrow part of the canyon. It gets so narrow you can almost put your hands on either side of it on the walls, on the canyon walls. And so I do all of this solo, you know, and it's kind of dangerous. And I try to pretend like I don't have any supplies. You know, I bring water and I bring something to eat, but I haven't eaten anything since I started this hike, and I've only had two small gulps of water. So I kind of try to pretend that I'm running out or I don't have it, just so I can see how far I can actually go before I feel like I'm in trouble. That way, if I ever do get in trouble, I know when I know when I should start panicking, how long I have before I'm in trouble. So that's a good idea to do that, you know. If I get real thirsty or I get hungry, I could just always reach into my pack, but I like to ration what I have so I can go long distances.
Entering one portion of the canyon in which he's hoping to explore, he begins to describe, and in the video you see this, that there are caves that line the walls along to his right and over to his left. Any of them presumably might have been the cave, but he describes again that the one that he'd found, the really weird one, had been much deeper and that there was something very different about that cave.
The canyon's getting a little more narrow. It looks like it's blocked off, but I can squeeze through that. It kind of turns into like an S, but it just keeps on going. And then there's lots of little caves, but they're not the kind of cave I'm looking for. The kind of cave I'm looking for is deep, and it's dark, and it's shaped just like the letter M. So lots of little caves and stuff along here, and it's about level with the ground, like an area like this. So I really got to keep my eyes peeled because I don't want to pass it. And there's actually caves all over the place up here. It's a really cool place. If you want to come spelunking, this is the place to come spelunking, man. Canyons galore. I must have passed three canyons already. Here's a little canyon, or a crevice more like it. It goes on up in there. It's kind of cool. I like going up in stuff like that because that's where I find my skulls, you know, off the beaten path. Not that this is a beaten path. Very, 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 very few people come down here. Did I say enough varies? So I'm going to shut the camera off again, and you can see that I'll be coming down here and going like an S. I'll be zigzagging back and forth through here, and it'll be getting skinnier and taller, and then I got to do some cliff descending down some cliffs. They're not too bad though, if I can remember right. It's been a while since I've been up here. So off with the camera. Ow, ooh, I almost fell. Bye.
Again, as a hiker and an outdoorsman myself, I almost cringe every time I hear him say, "Oh, almost fell." I know that feeling. Finally, at the end of his journey, Kenny hadn't managed to find the cave.
Well, I did not find the cave. That is so weird. I mean, I thought for sure I was just going to be able to find it. I remember it being fairly easy. Who knows? But I am at the mouth of the canyon. There, I'm just now coming out. And now I have to take a big left-hand turn and walk all the way back to my truck, which is a long, hard trip because I've got a lot of up and down to do. And that's it. I'll talk to you when I get back to my truck. Bye-bye.
And the video concludes with him finding a desert tortoise and filming the tortoise for a moment. He absolutely loves wildlife, and he focuses on a lot of wildlife throughout the video. It's pretty clear, and you can hear in his voice. Despite being nearly 50 years old, there's an incredible youth about Kenny Veach. And he had been someone who absolutely loved nature, loved pushing himself to the limits. As he describes in that one segment that you heard, he's talking about how far can I push myself, you know, picking up pine nuts off the desert floor to be able to snack on along the way, and having only water and maybe a couple of nature bars in his backpack, but pushing himself much further than he needs to go in case he ever got to a point where he felt that he was truly famished and perhaps in an emergency, so that he would know how his body will react. We could very much say of Kenny Veach, unlike a lot of these other instances where a person has gone missing, that despite the fact that he was, I guess you could say, a likely candidate for going missing as a result of the kind of terrain he's describing and the kind of physical exertion that he's putting himself up against in these situations, he nonetheless was very experienced, and perhaps also, in equal measure, knew better than most, as the videos document, how to handle himself in the desert. At one point, of course, he mentions going up into the desert, and it's up in this particular canyon where I find my skulls, he says. No doubt he was searching for animal skulls, and with hope, if not the safe return of Kenny, perhaps the very least we can hope for is perhaps that his own remains will be discovered, but as yet they have not been found. Now, what has been found, however, as reported by NBC affiliate News 3 in late November last year, his cell phone had been found. Now, this according to Red Rock Search and Rescue Commander Dave Cummings. He had reportedly told News 3 at the time that, quote, "We found his cell phone close to a very vertical old mine shaft, and we can't find another trail. It doesn't mean that he's down the mine shaft, but we have tracked him as far as we can. We're having our other crews come in from the search areas." And apparently at that time, several dozen Red Rock volunteer searches were combing the mountains looking for Kenny Veach. There had been an air and ground search earlier in the week just as well. Again, none of these concluded his ultimate whereabouts or final fate. But it was not believed at the time that he had indeed fallen down that mine shaft. The fact, of course, that in the video that he'd posted, the last that he posted a month prior to his disappearance, that he had indicated his desire to try and find this cave, has led many to believe that perhaps that is indeed what he set off to do. Maybe he found it. And with the difficulty that even Kenny Veach, having been experienced, having spent a lot of time in that area, with the difficulty that he expressed having tried to find this cave, no doubt it wouldn't be easy for others to find it either. But he was an experienced hiker. He was very familiar with the area. The temperatures are pretty mild in November. At one point in the video that he posts, he talks about toward the end feeling hot and says, "I wouldn't feel hot if I weren't out here hiking. If I weren't moving, I wouldn't be hot." So there's a lot of speculation about what exactly happens. But again, I don't think that this case might seem quite as mysterious if it hadn't been for his interest, maybe even obsession, some would say, with finding that cave, the way he described the vibrations coming from it as he neared it, the fear that that aroused in him, and of course the proximity, he said. This cave had been near Nellis Air Force Base. Of course, in UFO literature, there's a bit of a history about that area. Whether or not that plays into what ultimately led to Kenny's disappearance, we may never know. We may never know fully what ever happened to him, but it is our hope, of course, for Kenny's sake and for those who cared about him, that maybe one day there will be closure and that we'll understand a little better what may have happened to him. And from what we are able to tell of Kenny in his videos, I mean, he was upbeat, he was very positive. I think that he would want, if nothing else, for people to know how careful you have to be when you're out there in wild America. The area that he pitted himself against was rugged, it was dangerous, and at very least, I think that Kenny Veach, bright soul that he was, he would want people to know about those dangers. And of course, to know that the very same fate may await anyone who isn't on their guard at all times when they put themselves against the elements for days at a time. My hearts go out to him, and we'll wrap things up on the final segment of this week's edition of the Grayling Report right after this. Welcome to the final segment of this week's edition of the Gray Lead Report. I'm Micah Hanks. So, on the heels of our discussion about Kenny Veach, truly a heartbreaking story, and my heart personally goes out to anyone who is among the family members of those who have to endure these kinds of disappearances. It's really, really a troubling set of circumstances any time anyone goes missing. Kenny's story is indeed strange. We'll hope to find more as time goes on, to learn more about what may have happened to him. But as of this moment, it still remains, of course, a mystery, and certainly one of the strangest that I think I've come across in my own personal research into missing person cases. But speaking of missing people, it's been an ongoing problem lately in China. That's right, people who just vanish. And apparently these days it doesn't take much to vanish in that country, especially if you're someone who's recognized in the business world. A recent spate of disappearances, BBC News has reported on this, Reuters just as well, and we'll talk about it here a bit too, have been occurring in China, these disappearances. They involve mostly the bosses of some of the country's top industries. And of course, this has many people questioning whether some kind of conspiracy could be at work. So the latest among these incidents involves the disappearance of Guo Gangcheng. He was the chairman of the Fosun International Company, which BBC News had described as one of China's most prominent asset management firms. Now, the company had issued a statement late last week stating that its shares have been suspended in the wake of Gangcheng's disappearance. Now, Fosun International isn't the only company that has apparently been affected by these alleged disappearances. In recent weeks, Hong Kong's Guotai company has also seen shares in its stocks falling in the aftermath of an announcement that the company had to make. They had to literally go out and announce that their chief executive had vanished. Citic Securities, also perhaps China's very largest brokerage, has similarly lost two of its prominent investment bankers in recent weeks and has had to make announcements thusly. And so I guess the question on everybody's mind right now, in China and elsewhere, is where have these businessmen gone? Now, Guangcheng's disappearance is notable among the rest, especially since the Fosun chairman had apparently likened himself to being an Eastern counterpart to America's Warren Buffett. His company had also recently made a number of acquisitions, as was reported late last week by the BBC. Some have speculated that this may have something to do with the disappearance, although it isn't the only theory about the rash of missing Chinese executives. Now, early in 2015, Beijing had undergone a number of high-profile investigations into businesses, particularly these brokerages, which the Chinese government had believed were seeking to profit from severe volatility in the Chinese stock market. And of course, since the financial sector had been no stranger to fiddling and volatility and, of course, questionable ethics in the past, some have asserted that the government is merely closing its grip around those who might take liberties with the financial system as it stands. And so, in light of all this, some are attributing these disappearances, considering that it's mostly high-profile businessmen, to something that's called Shuanggai, which is a process that involves detention, and this is enacted by the Chinese ruling party. Shuanggai apparently occurs if it is a member of that party. If it's someone who is not a member of the party, they have a different term, Shuangzai. Now, President Xi Jinping has instituted this policy as an anti-corruption tactic throughout his campaign, and it's not necessarily just big businessmen who, under such policies, may be going missing. You know, last month it was also reported that there was a smaller company, a company called Causeways. Actually, it was a bookshop, but they have a printing operation just as well. And it had been reported at that time that the Causeways bookstore typically published really politically driven material. They had a lot of paperbacks and things that were kind of speculative, a lot of conspiracy kind of stuff. And it was reported in November that four of the employees of the Causeways bookstore had apparently also vanished, just like these businessmen in Hong Kong and Beijing. Those associated at that time with the missing employees were convinced that the disappearances had been due to similar political detentions. Now, can you imagine? We talk about, for instance, Alex Jones a fair bit on this program. Alex drives me nuts with some of the things that he says. I mean, he'll make such ridiculous allegations against people. But then when Donald Trump, who has tweeted already now that he's flirting, well, in truth, I guess I should say that he has alluded to flirting with an independent run. You know, he's talking about the voter base that follows him in the polls. I think the latest poll today was at 41%. I mean, that's really unprecedented. Obviously, the Democrats are afraid, as well as the Republicans, when someone like Donald Trump is carrying such an incredible margin leading up to an election. And here this guy is going around saying this, and I noticed that when Alex Jones interviews him on InfoWars, I mean, talk about softballing. You know, this guy is asked about, probably by one of the leading advocates, whatever you think of Alex Jones, you know, he's one of the leading advocates for small government. And when asked about his own government policies, I mean, Trump all but tells Alex Jones, you know, actually, I think we need bigger government in a lot of cases. And of course, now he's also apparently, with his style of big government, saying that he would close the borders completely to all Muslims. You know, I don't want to get too political here, but it's just interesting because if people in this country were treated like they are often in China, you know, when they say things like that, they'd just vanish. We wouldn't have any more Alex Jones. That guy would have been gone a long time ago. And in circumstances like this, I guess what we really have to be thankful for is the actual freedom and the actual liberty that we are afforded. You know, and we don't have businessmen and publishers of, you know, small printing outfits and the like that vanish because they express the kind of opinions that they have about things as they are happening in the world. And sometimes I think with all the trouble and with all the speculation and all the paranoia and all the concern and all the craziness that we are seeing in America and abroad, you know, with ISIS and all of the threat of terrorism, a legitimate threat, however any one potential presidential hopeful may respond to such a threat. And of course, I don't agree with Donald Trump and his estimations about how we can solve this problem. I saw Larry Kudlow over at National Review is saying that he thinks that we do need to close the borders. I mean, we're getting very close to the kind of sentiments that we haven't seen since around the time of the Second World War. But I'm fascinated with the political environment leading up to and immediately after the Second World War, both in America and in Germany and other parts of the world. You look at, and if you've ever read, if you haven't, you really should, but we had Peter Levenda on the program a while back, and you know, in the book Unholy Alliance, he looks at the way that occult influences really kind of fostered the political environment that led to National Socialism under the Nazi Party and under Adolf Hitler. And then after the Second World War, you look at the paranoia. We've just emerged from a war. We don't want it to happen again. And McCarthyism. You know, we look at, of course, the Cold War. We look at the innumerable problems that we faced. And, of course, the lingering threat of mutually assured self-destruction between the USSR and the United States. It was indeed a frightening time. And we've been saying for quite a while that with the strange relationships between the East and the West emerging right now, that it's getting close to that. But of course, with the threat of terror, and as a result of that, the concerns people are beginning to express about treatment of minorities and religious groups, and the kind of fallout that might occur as a result of concerns. I tell you, troubling times indeed. It really does help at such moments to know history so that you can see the warning signs leading up to potential problems in the future. Who knows, maybe Elon Musk is right. Maybe we should just get our butts up there to Mars as quick as we can. We may indeed miss the window, as he's saying right now. Stranger things have happened, and history, of course, gives us plenty of precedent for that. That'll be the final word this week on the program. Thank you again, as always, for all that you do, and of course, just for tuning in and listening. On behalf of all of us here at Graylian International, Caleb Hanks, Matthew Oakley, Chris Hayes, Jeremy London, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Matthew Oakley, Raisin Robin Hobbs, Tyler Pittman, and yours truly, I remain Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. We'll catch you guys next week, and as always, stay strange out there.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.